Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 1st. I'm Ray Graff. It's bird time, and our favorite bird experts are back with us. Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart will share their birding knowledge and answer your questions. If you have a question about the birds, call 800-348-2551. Don't be shy. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. The number is 800-348-2551. This is the time of year when the birds are making some whoopee, and we'll talk about that coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing birds today, and we welcome our avian experts, Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. Rich is retired from the New York State DEC. He's at large somewhere in the country. He's now the regional reviewer for the premier birding site, eBird. Julie Hart is the project coordinator, or was, I'm not sure if this is still going on for a while, the New York Breeding Bird Atlas. She coordinates with thousands of volunteers to document bird breeding behaviors. She's got a focus on bird conservation and citizen science. Always a great guest on this program. Our number is 800-348-2551. If the birds confuse you, or maybe they interest you in some way, we'd love to hear from you. 800-348-2551 or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Julie Hart, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. And I can clarify, I'm still the project coordinator for the Breeding Bird Atlas. It's just that we've moved into like a different phase of the project.
Divorce?
Yeah. Well, it does kind of feel like a divorce. So it was like I had a year of preparation,
right,
and then 5 years of this whole citizen science.
Yeah.
A part of the project where we're collecting data. And now we've got at least like 3 years ahead of us just to analyze the data and produce a book. But it does feel a little bit like a divorce because I miss interacting with all the volunteers.
Will it happen again? I mean, this was, I would say, based on, no, I'm no expert on anything, but it seems to me like this was a big success. And,
yes.
And will it happen again?
It will. Yeah. Well, we're scheduled to do the next one starting in 2040.
2040?
Yeah, so they do it, we do it every 20 years because it's a multi-million dollar project. It takes thousands and thousands of volunteers. It's a huge effort. It takes about 10 years or more just for that one project. Even though the public really only sees the 5 years that we're collecting data, there's another 5 years around it just to prepare and plan and then to summarize everything.
Still,
and stuff.
That's 15 years. You know, it could be an asteroid strike
still
by then, right?
15 years, yes. That's true. Yeah, you never know what can happen, but I'm sure there will be a lot of changes and we'll document a lot of changes.
Well, so. Julie, it's always fun to play another rousing version of the game, Where in the World is Rich Guthrie? And Rich, where are you?
Hey there. Good afternoon. First of all, you hear me okay? Everything good?
As well as we usually do. Well, you haven't been in the studio in a long time. What's happening?
Oh, I'm down in Virginia right now, and I'm homeward bound, that's for sure.
Well,
I'm coming north with the spring migrants. That's me.
Excellent. So good. We will see you. We will see you maybe next time. The number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a bird question. And I'll start with Julie, and then we'll throw it over to Rich. We were out taking the air the other day. I think it might have been yesterday. We had a power outage yesterday, and we didn't have power for 16 hours. And,
what?
Ridiculous.
A sunny day?
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's a long story, and I'm annoyed, but that's okay. Power came back at 5 minutes of 4 in the morning. We're out taking the air, and there was a really loud robin, and we saw him. He was up there, and he was hanging out, and above him, seemingly talking back, a few branches up in this evergreen tree, was a lady robin, and they seemed to have sort of they would kind of flit close to each other and then fly away. And eventually, the lady robin said, look, you're a loser, buddy. I'm out.
Not ready.
Now, is this mating? Is this kind of a mating ritual?
Yeah. It a lot of birds are starting to come back, and so we've been seeing a big influx in robins. Probably everyone has been hearing them singing a lot more.
Loud.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And they're like one of the first ones in the morning and the last ones in the evening, right? But yeah, I've already been seeing lots of courtship behavior. House finches, mourning doves, robins. Geese are already on nest, so are eagles and ravens and things like that. So yeah, there's already a lot of breeding behavior going on.
Well, that's very exciting. Rich Guthrie, I was out up on the roof a little while ago, and we had beautiful blue skies, and clearly there were thermals, because I saw one big, huge bird. It looked like it had black sort of coloration on the tips of its wings, but I'm not sure because it was pretty far away. It was riding these thermals, and at one point, Rich, it seemed like it wasn't even moving at all. It just kind of hung there in the air. Tell me about thermals and why do they do that, and then what do they do after that?
Hey, good idea. Now is the time. First of all, it's probably one of the hawk species out there. And a few of the possibilities run through my mind. But more importantly, your point about thermals is really interesting. It's a phenomenon that migrating birds, especially hawks and large soaring birds like storks and pelicans and the like, will utilize to get effortlessly from place to place. And they go thousands of miles just hopscotching, hitch riding on thermals. And an interesting thing about thermals is, I believe, and this is something I'm going to put out there, and that is that in my opinion and from observations, birds' visual acuity is accurate enough that they can actually see the air density differences in the rising warm air thermals versus the colder air that is riding down the edge of their bubble. And so they search them out. Yeah, I think they can. We can see it to an extent ourselves in a thicker medium such as water. We see densities of water shifting around. And I think with the birds' incredible acuity, they can see that in the air currents as well. And they ride that. Gulls will ride the bow wake in stream, the wind stream of a passing ship going by. You can see them riding the bow wake like porpoises do in the water. So I think there's something to that, Ray. You're onto something there. Good job.
I don't know. I mean, how can a bird see density of air when it's a clear blue sky unless you're talking about heat?
Heat shimmer.
But do the eyes of the birds, can they capture infrared? Will they see a hotter spot in the air? Julie?
I don't think it's the infrared part of it. I do think, though, it's the air density part of it and the movement of one air a mixture with another, the lighter air being bubbling up against the colder air. It's something I've been mulling over for quite some time, and watching how some birds will actually seek out the rising air currents. And you can see that with in the formation of geese, the V formation. Looking at the wind stream of the goose in front of them like a bicyclist does on a long-distance race. So I think there's something in there, Ray, that okay. I've been mulling that over for years, and this is the first I've spoken of it, and I think that's kind of fun to speculate about.
Interesting.
Yeah, I wonder, too, how much of it is. I know I've heard stories like if there's other birds that – like if they can see another bird that's in a thermal, then that attracts them to a thermal that someone else has already found.
And then
I think there's also some landscape like features that some birds can key in on as well. But whether they can see the change in density in the air, I have no idea.
It's so interesting. You know, this bird was by himself, and it was right out here in Albany. It's not exactly forest land. But this guy was having a great time. All right, here's an email, and then we'll take a break. 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. This is from Brent in Campbell Hall. Two questions, and I'll throw them to you first, Julie. We're on a large wooded piece of land, and there are a lot of turkey vultures around. They seem local, but where do they nest? Or do they roost in trees at night like the wild turkeys? Also, do they migrate like other birds or just tough it out for the winter?
There's a lot of questions there.
All right.
So turkey vultures do migrate. They go down south for the winter. They are just now coming back. They are riding all the thermals and coming back up here. They do roost in trees when they're not nesting or when they're migrating or on wintering grounds, but they tend to breed most often around here. They're breeding in like abandoned barns or barns that have like openings that they can get into.
Really?
Something like that, like an abandoned structure. So a lot of times we don't find the nest. We don't see them because they're, out of sight.
So if they find an old barn then, how do they make their nest? Or do they just find a corner and sit on down on the wood?
Yeah, exactly. They don't really make a nest. They'll just lay the eggs right on like a cross beam or something, or a ledge or whatever, and that's it.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Rich, you want to add anything before we take a break?
Sure. Yes, and I agree with Julie on that 100%. And before barns, they had to resort to cliff faces and crevices and ledges and the like. Mm-hmm. And they still do that, but some of the more modern vultures will find a good old barn or a silo to utilize.
All right. Get a room, they always say. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Little Cal Jader, Fried Bananas. That's a Gary McFarland composition. There's an underappreciated composer there. That's Cal Jader and the group Fried Bananas. Hey, listen, while I have a minute, thanks to all of you who made the trek to Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck yesterday for whatever it is we did. It was Baking with Gail Sokol. It was a live event. You guys were great. Thank you for being there and making us feel at home. Thanks to Chef Kroner. I'll tell you, I've never been to Rhinebeck before. What a lovely, spend any time there. It's a lovely place. Oh my gosh. So anyway, thanks for being there. Someday, when Phil Spector is out of prison, he'll edit the thing and it'll be great. 800-348-2551 is the number to call. It's Birds Today with Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. And let's go to, we better call Saul. He's in Schenectady. You're on. Go ahead.
Hi there. I saw a couple of very large birds soaring near Niskayuna the other day, and their wings were not straight out from the side of their bodies, but very much up, so there was a V shape to them, to the bird, and I have no idea what they were.
Julie.
It sounds very much like a turkey vulture. So they just came back like this weekend in pretty good numbers, and that is what we call a dihedral, that with the arms or the wings just slightly up at an angle, and that's pretty diagnostic for turkey vulture. Black vulture is different,
really,
but turkey vultures have that dihedral.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the black vultures are the relatively newcomer to
this
era?
They're the newcomers. They're a little bit smaller. They have a short, square tail.
They got attitude.
Yes, they do. They hang out all winter, too.
Yeah.
So they're all a different beast. But yeah,
Saul,
turkey vulture.
Thanks a lot. Rich, we talked about thermals earlier. And mm-hmm. this guy I saw today was all by himself. There was nobody around. The turkey vultures and the black vultures, they're kind of gregarious. They hang out together, right?
Well, they do. They will spread out and scan the countryside for lunch and dinner. And like Julie says, they keep an eye on one another. And when one of them starts circling down to a prospect, they latch on to it and they kind of join up. And then when that happens, then you got a congregation. And they also utilize the same wind air thermal currents that one another uses. So that will draw them together like leaves in the fall wind. And when not nesting, they are very gregarious. They will gather in sometimes in large numbers at a communal roost. Now, that may be a pine grove or a cell tower, radio tower, any sort of perch that offers multiple opportunities for everybody to kind of get together and chat.
It's Birds Today with Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. Anne from Williamsburg writes in, please speak about sandhill cranes in New England and where they are nesting. Rich, I'll throw that to you.
Oh, wow. Good question. Sandhill cranes are a new phenomenon. They were typically found to our south and also out west. Over the recent decades, they've expanded their range, coming in and are now nesting in many places in New York, New England, and elsewhere, where they have previously been unknown. Very rare birds and often not seen. But now they are here. Quite a large number of them nest out there in Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge in west of Syracuse, New York. And there are scatterings of their nestings in Vermont, Massachusetts, and down south of us in New Jersey and southern counties of New York. So, yeah, they're out there. And I think that folks like to keep their nesting sites a little under wraps because they are somewhat vulnerable during that time of their life cycle. But joining up with one of the local bird clubs and joining them on some outings, some of them may include sandhill crane nest sites. Worth an investigation.
Speaking of that, it just reminded me, Julie, a couple weeks ago, or I don't know, whatever, we had some wildlife biologists on, and they were talking about the wackadoodles or the woodcocks or
timber
whatever.
Timberdoodles.
Yeah, timberdoodles. It's that time of year for them,
it
too,
is.
Right?
Yeah, I just was watching them last night over at Five Rivers doing their funky courtship display. So
they're weird little birds.
They are very weird little birds. They're a shorebird that lives on the edge of the forest in the uplands, and they have this big long bill that they probe in the ground for worms, and then they do this fantastic courtship display where they fly way high up, like in the spiral, and then they spiral down and make all these funny noises with their tail feathers and stuff. And it's really cool.
So the male does this or the female?
The males do this.
And the female's supposed to be impressed by that?
The females are impressed.
Okay.
And then
nature takes its course.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Christine writes in, I observed two Canada geese hanging out on my neighbor's lawn. They stayed for several days. Are they still okay? Are they missing their flock? Didn't see them today. Should I be worried? And that's from Christine in Waterville. Rich.
Yeah, they're fine. In fact, they're probably ready to do their thing. Canada geese are very, very early nesting bird species in our area. And I wouldn't be surprised that this is a bonded pair. And the next thing you know, you're going to have a bunch of little goslings sooner than you think.
That's nice. Okay, let's go back to our phones. Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart are here. It's Birds, 800-348-2551. Blake is in Hopewell Junction. Hello, Blake.
Hi, I'm clearing out some land and trying to reintroduce some native grasses. I'm wondering if there's any reason I should be hopeful that I could reintroduce some quail to this area.
Julie Hart.
It's unlikely. There's some bobwhite quails that are released every year for hunting purposes around the state, but there's very few. I think there's maybe one or two locations on Long Island where they may still live in the wild and survive the winter. But most of them, they're not gonna survive.
Mm. Rich.
Yeah, when I started out with the old conservation department, we used to have a game farm down your neck of the woods. And part of the game then was release quail, release quail, release quail. That simply did not work.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice is forget about it. Try something else.
What about pheasant?
Pheasant?
Same thing. Yeah. Pheasants, same story. Thing, yeah. They don't they just simply don't do well. They may hang on for a few years, maybe even a decade or so, but sooner or later, like we have now, any of these released populations of pheasants are pretty much gone. Mm-hmm. The only places where they are sustained is where they keep tossing them out. And and even those, their days are numbered.
All right, Blake, thanks a lot. Go ahead, Julie.
As I say, that I'll add that there are, you know, some known forest management practices that would be helpful for supporting woodcock and ruffed grouse. And so they're, you know, keeping it like an early successional stage and having logs on the ground and having, you know, some young poplar trees, things like that,
so,
can help attract some of the native birds that use that habitat.
And so this is the same for quail and pheasant. They like the younger growth forests. Very interesting. And there are none. I heard tell that maybe some Binghamton way, there may be some spots where the habitat's pretty good
for quail,
pheasants. No. Okay, let me ask you both the question, and I'll start with you, Julie, because I can see you. Rich Guthrie, who knows where he is? Listen, there is the...
You're better off, Ray.
Yeah, well, believe me, I didn't go that far, but thanks for bringing it up. The New York State and other states, they will release pheasants, right, for hunting purposes?
Yep.
Where do you stand on this, philosophically, Julie Hart?
I personally, it seems like kind of wasteful, just because, I mean, in terms of resources, because those birds they're basically just being released just to be shot for fun, for sport. And I know some people are eating them, most people are eating them, but it seems like we could do better with improving the habitat for our native birds. That's my opinion.
What do you think, Rich?
Well, it's kind of goes in the same category as stocking fish in the trout streams. Some of them are suitable for the effort, and some of them are not. Some of the efforts for pheasant are suitable for the effort. And there is a contingent out there that helps support wildlife habitat management and conservation that are kind of like paying the player to conduct these activities. So with respect to their interests, there is an ongoing effort to maintain their sport outfit. And that's what it is. It's a sporting event, and people participate in it. And for what it's worth, I mean, it is an expensive proposition, but they are the ones that are more or less paying the bill. And so there you go. Pheasants are still being released, not so much quail, I don't think. And I don't think we're not trying any new species like we used to try the green pheasant and
gray
partridge, Hungarian partridge. Those things, you know, they've totally given up on those. But the pheasants are hanging on.
Let's go back to our phone lines. It's Birds Today with Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. 800-348-2551 is the number. Laura is in Bennington. Hello, Laura in Bennington. How are you?
Hi. Hi. I'm great. I'm excited.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I go over to the deer park a lot where there's a pond and about a couple hundred mallards and usually one goose, and now there are four. But the other day, there was a pair of mergansers swimming around in the pond. And I think they were mergansers, the white with black head and brown with dark brown head pair. And they were swimming around all day, and then they, that was it. They only stayed for the one day. Hmm. So what's up with the mergansers? Why can't they stay?
Julie, what's up with the mergansers?
Mergansers, presuming they were common mergansers, they tend to like larger lakes, larger bodies of water, and they are just now coming back en masse as well. And most of them are breeding a little further north, kind of little.
Oh,
like, yeah.
Well, it was so exciting.
It is exciting. Yeah.
Rich, you want to add anything there?
Yeah, I love mergansers. They're a fish-eating duck. They dive underwater, and they, these birds have almost like teeth on their bill that they use to grab and hold on to the fish, slippery, slimy fish.
Oh, cool.
And the common mergansers do nest in our area. We're sort of at the fringe of their range. And some of the more isolated stretches of our streams are habitat for nesting common mergansers. And a hooded merganser will also nest, and they like small little ponds. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful, one of the more beautiful ducks that are out there. Keep an eye out for the little hooded mergansers, tiny little things. Yeah, they will nest in our area as well. Yes, good job.
Laura, thanks for the call. It's Birds Today with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart, 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. Pat in Oneonta writes, I sent Rich pictures of cedar waxwings here in our Oneonta backyard crab apple last week after first picking them up on my Merlin app. Such a treat to see them. But we now have not seen them for several days. Have they moved on? Also, well, there's two parts of this. So what do you think about the cedar waxwings, Rich?
Well, they were there, and again, there was, you know, I have so many favorites out there, and they are right high on the top of the list. Cedar waxwings. They probably finished up what they needed off that tree and are headed back into foraging elsewhere. They're one of the last nesting species in the season, way back in the end of summer. So they got plenty of time to do their thing meanwhile. And so, yeah, they're kind of like a group, a sociable bird, moving around, nomadic, looking for the next meal.
All right. The second
good job with the crab apples. Yeah.
The second part of this, I'll throw to Julie. When should we put out oranges and grape jelly for the Baltimore Orioles? We had them for weeks and weeks last spring. We saw them beginning in May last year, but are they here earlier? And that again is from Pat in Oneonta.
They're not quite here yet. As they noted, they tend to like fruit, and there's not a whole lot of fruit for them quite yet. So they do come later in, Rich, you probably know a date better than I do, but I was thinking like mid-May.
Yeah, I look for them about the end of the first week of May and thereabouts. And I hear them long before I see them because they're pretty good at hiding in the treetops.
All right, number here is 800-348-2551. One more email, and then we'll jump back to the phones for now. Jill in Rhinebeck, my new favorite town. I love the Rhinebeck. Jill writes, I have an old concrete bird bath that I love. It's leaking. Can you suggest a safe product to use that won't harm the birds?
I have the same problem. My concrete water bath, the stem of it just broke in half. There must have been a small fracture, and then the ice got in and broke it.
Yeah.
And so I haven't looked for products, but mine's not in the part where they drink. So
but
I think
I
can use like a cement sealer or something for my issue. But for that one, if it's up in the bowl part where they're drinking, I'm not sure.
Can't you just put more cement in?
You could, yeah. Probably, yeah, you could put a thin layer of cement in there.
Rich, what's up?
Well, I'll have to rely on Julie's research on her solution to the problem there. But I do endorse having some sort of water feature in any kind of backyard bird habitat. That's you know, that's a main attraction, sometimes even more successful than the bird seed that you might put out. Native plants and fruits and flowers and some water feature. Go for it. I use a plastic, somewhat plastic container, and that works well. It holds the water, and the birds like it and suits the purposes.
It's Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart, Birds Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's grab a call, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll do more things that we usually do here on the show. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris.
Yeah, I was wondering if there are any gold eagles in the Northeast.
Any golden eagles in the Northeast? Julie?
They are not known to breed. There's been a couple of pairs over the last decade or so that have kind of hinted that they might try to breed, but nobody has really stuck around and done it. So, but they do migrate through. And so right now, I think somebody just reported one yesterday around Albany.
Huh.
So you'll see them in the spring and the fall migrating.
Okay. Rich?
Yeah, they do, and they winter in our area. One of our best golden eagle spotting in all the Northeast is right down in our neighborhood in Oneonta, New York. And each fall, November, thereabouts, they get hundreds of, well, 100 or more golden eagles over the course of the late fall season. They do winter in our area. There's some places in Dutchess County that are known wintering areas for golden eagles. But in the general Albany and western Massachusetts area, they're mainly transient, but they do pass through for sure.
All right, this email came in about golden eagles, and this is from Amy. It says, eBird says golden eagles, Rensselaer County Trail Camp on private property. Please confirm if possible. Rich, you can't see it, but I'm going to hand the pictures over to Julie Hart, and there's some, it looks like a fairly grisly scene. It was taken by Zapruder. What do you think?
Yeah.
No?
The one on the left, there's two birds in the picture, and they're on a deer carcass. The one on the left is definitely a bald eagle.
A bald eagle.
The one on the right that's on the carcass, it's hard to say.
But eBird is never wrong, right, Rich?
Oh, no. No. That's not true.
Okay, don't get me started.
All right, fine.
But golden eagle in Rensselaer County is a definite possibility. I mean, the isolated one or two, especially if there's a deer carcass, they will find it. They'll latch onto it like the bald eagle does as well. The bald eagle is primarily known as a bird near water going after fish. But you put some food out there, or there's some food in the woods, they find it. You got them.
All right, listen, we have a billion calls, and we got to get to a bunch of them. But let's take a break here, Zach the engineer. 800-348-2551. That's the number, and we'll be back. Blues and F, there's J.J. Johnson, 800-348-2551. It's Birds Today, Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie join us. And let's see, we will go to Saugerties, and it's time for Gerald. Gerald, you're on.
Yes, hi. I've been tempted to call this story in for years, and today Rich Guthrie talking about the birds being able to see up currents has demanded that I tell the story.
Okay.
It was a gray in between winter and summer, whether it was spring or fall, I don't know. Still gray day. I was walking in the woods and suddenly I heard a like screech bird call above, looked up, and I saw the first of a very long line of widely spaced large birds gliding, second only to turkey vultures in the time they spent gliding as opposed to wing flapping. The first bird went into a circle about 100, well, he was about 200 feet above me, about 100 feet above the trees, and he went into a circle about 100 feet away. So I was right almost directly under this to observe this. The birds were about 100 yards apart, 300 feet. There were, by the end of the procession, there were probably 15 to 20 of these birds. They were wingspread probably equal to a turkey vulture, pure white birds with black wingtips. About the outer third of each wing was black. They circled around a circle of about 80 feet in diameter. Once they were in the circle, they would flap to maintain their whatever, equilibrium, I guess. And as they went around, one, you know, and the next went in, but they were a long way apart. So this took several minutes. I think the first bird must have been a mile ahead of the last one. They went around and around to a height of maybe 1,000 feet. I could not see Now, this was 20 to 30 years ago. Uh-huh. I do not recall that I could see any distinction in the gray clouds that might have had an indentation from the uprising air for the birds to see. But wherever the clouds were, they were higher than the 1,000-foot top altitude. These birds came in going north, but slightly west of north, and they went out of the circle at the top, heading northeast.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's the story.
All right. So, Rich Guthrie, you go first.
Well, I'm impressed, and thank you for that. Now, and your description has me wondering just what kind of birds they might actually have been. And what comes to mind, and Julie, you may chime in on this, but I'm thinking that you probably saw a displaced vagrant flock of white pelicans that fit that description, and
no, that is a matter of...
Okay, Gerald is...
Not pelicans.
No,
not pelicans. The wings were as wide a wingspan as a turkey vulture, but narrow.
So what about
All right, Julie, go ahead.
What about osprey?
I think they might have been
gannet. Hey, Julie, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what about osprey? Because sometimes during migration season, you'll get big groups of them in a kettle like that.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, and more likely, actually. And that's a very possibility. And again, it's a gliding or soaring birds that take advantage of windsurfing these currents. And there might have been some turbulence in the air, weather-related turbulence that they can pick up, and they found a good, reliable uplift to work with. And that's what they do. They find the bottom, like a brown creeper climbing a tree. They'll go to the bottom of the lift and ride it up as high as they can, and then glide off or peel off into the searching for the next one, circling from thermal to thermal on their way north. They kind of effortless way of traveling.
Gerald, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a long call. We got a lot of people on the line. Let's go to Jill in Stanfordville. Jill, you're on.
Hi. Am I here? Am I on?
I don't know. Are you here? I can hear you.
Yeah, yes. I've never done this.
Welcome.
I have a small barn that has a pair of phoebes that come back every year to nest. And the nest, they keep building up each year on the nest. So the nest now is about 12 inches tall, but they're running out of room at the top. Oh. And I'm afraid they're not going to be able, the baby is going to fall out this year. Should I take that nest down? Should I, like, remove a lot of the nest and leave one at the bottom? What should I do?
Julie Hart.
I would remove all of them. I think they'll either build a nest nearby somewhere else, or if you replace them all, they'll just build in that same spot, and that's fine.
Rich.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. They'll come back. And nest building is part of their courtship, so it's good exercise for them.
All right, fair enough. Jill, thanks a lot. Thanks for being a first-time caller. Did you have fun?
Yes, I'm at the supermarket. I'm not good at multitasking. Thank you.
You did very well. Thank you for calling. I love phoebes. I think I told you the story a couple of years ago. Ours got kicked out. They were under our overhang and some terrible...
The house sparrows
or whatever just came and kicked them out. There was a fight. It was all the crows were watching. It was like Ali Frazier. It was great. Let's
neighborhood
go.
Drama.
Let's go to Jay and Sharon Springs. Jay, you're on.
Hey, Ray, love the show.
Thanks.
I have to ask your guest. Every year I try to tell the people who follow me on my Facebook that there's one day in spring. It usually happens at the beginning of March here in the Catskills, and it happens one day in August where it will be dead silence from winter, and the next day all the songbirds, like, they all got an email, they all sing at the same time, and it's like night and day. And the same thing happens in summer here. It's around August where it will be loud, obnoxious summer sounds, and then the next day dead silent like winter. Do you guys know that?
Rich.
Yeah, and it's one of those things. You get these fallout days and migration where they all come up mostly at night. So they're arriving in the morning, and first thing they want to do is stake out a claim. And the way they do that is by singing. So you got the raucous call of these returning residents that are looking for their territory and announcing to the world that they're back.
And the same thing in summer, when they just stop all of a sudden. It's like night and day.
Well, it's the flip side of the coin during at then. I think the timing may be a little more spread out, but it's, you know, a lot of that is at the opportunity of your observation. So that, once they're done nesting and staking out their territory, defending it for raising their new brood, they stop singing. There's no real reason to keep singing, drawing attention to themselves. So they kind of dummy up and go on with preparing for fall migration. So it's a matter of the different kind of species and the timing of their annual rituals.
Julie Hart.
Awesome. Thank you.
Julie?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in terms of breeding, as we're talking about all of this singing and the courtship behavior and everything.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, and we're running out of time a little bit, just to put a little notice out there for people that this is the time of year to be preparing for the coming breeding season. So if you have bird boxes, nest boxes, now's the time to clean those out, remove all the material that's in there. And then if you've had feeders out all winter, now is also a great time to do a really deep clean of all of your feeders. So use, you know, a bleach solution. You can soak it in warm water with some dish detergent or something too. It helps get some of the grime out of there, and then make sure that they're fully dried before you hang them back up again. But now is a great time to be doing that kind of stuff.
It's getting to be bear season now too. So are you taking your feeders up?
Right. So this is the time of year, where we keep an eye out. There's usually, seems like we often get one young bear moving through in April in Del Mar. And so they can be anywhere. So yeah, as soon as you see or hear anything about bears, they should come down sure. If you're in deep bear country, you should take your feeders down now.
Gloria is in Albany. Gloria, you're on.
Hi, I have a really strange question.
Okay.
I have a birdhouse right outside my kitchen window, and I've been watching for about a week and a half. There's a house sparrow and two other prettier sparrows all hanging out around the house, and they go in and out, and they seem very happy all together. What is that about?
I don't think they're
don't
happy
know.
With one another.
Yeah, yeah. That would be my guess, too.
It's funny. I look at them, and they're not fighting, but they keep going in and out, all three of them. They go in and out. They seem to be getting along. It's really strange. The house will
I'm just wondering, are you dealing with perhaps the male and female house sparrows, the same species but looking very different? Could that be the case?
That could be the case, but there's always three.
There
will be one up on the top, one up, and two on the edge of the birdhouse.
Huh.
It's very strange. I can't figure it out. And I do have a dove nesting in the hemlock right next to it, too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they're one of the most careless nest builders out there. hardly a nest, if you want to even call it that.
It is.
And how
they just
even
hit on a couple branches or whatever. Mm-hmm. I went outside to look at it, and this the doves nest there every year. But these sparrows are just really strange, all three of them.
Julie.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they're just still trying to figure out who's going to mate with whom, who's going to be paired up.
Maybe it's a throuple.
Like, it could
be. You know what I mean?
It could be a trio. I mean, I don't know.
All right, Gloria, thanks a lot for that one. Let's go to Barbara in Sheffield. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. I have another very weird question or story. I had a couple of years ago, I had a white Taurus station wagon. And every day I would go out, and the right rearview mirror on the passenger side was covered with bird poop.
Oh, yes.
I mean, so much so that I have to scrape it off. And I sort of just did it, you know, I wondered. And then I said, it would happen day after day. Huh. And then I looked out, and there is this huge fat robin sitting on it, just pooping.
Oh,
all
tremendous.
Over it.
Thanks for the image.
I mean, really, it was the strangest natural phenomenon I'd ever seen. And I finally had to put a plastic bag over it every night. Now, what would cause that bird to do that?
Okay.
Anybody.
Maybe it needs more fiber. All right, Rich, you go first, and then Julie, and then we'll move it along.
Okay, that's the robin trying to drive away the other robin that's not really there. It's only his reflection. And he gets so excited, covering it over like you did is...
Go ahead,
yes.
Rich.
Oh,
yes.
Covering it over. It never dawned on me. He thought it was another bird.
So exactly. Let me get this straight. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, Julie. So this robin sees his reflection, and then he goes to the bathroom. How is that an evolutionary thing that works out?
I don't know.
I mean, so I actually had come up with a different scenario in my head, although that one is totally valid as well. But I was wondering if there was a robin nest somewhere underneath, right nearby.
No, it was my car parked in the driveway, and it was just all over the glass of it. I'm not saying just a casual little poop.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think we got the picture there. You don't drive a Buick Skylark, do you? Because maybe that.
No, I haven't.
They throw the skylark and then. All right,
some bird species do poop on threatening.
Really.
Individuals. So I mean, for example, I'm thinking of terns. Although that's kind of a very different bird than what we're talking about, but terns will aim their poop just to hit it on you.
All right, check, please. Barbara, thank you very much. Let's quickly go. We only have about 30 seconds. Let's go to Anne-Marie and Colony. Anne, you only have about 30 seconds to pose the question.
Okay, thank you. I'm really looking for advice on how to deter the birds from nesting under my carport and adding their poop to my car and my driveway.
Splendid. The password is poop. All right, Julie, you first.
It is.
Must be some nice ledges or something somewhere that they can put a nest. So you can get spikes.
Sure.
Yeah, you can get some spikes to attach to that ledge.
But you got
to
get the right size.
Right. Yep, exactly. To try to keep them from nesting there.
It didn't work for us because we bought big ones, and the little birds were like, no problem. We'll go in between these.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did clean out the whole area like 2 years ago, and someone told me the pheromones remain, and you need to do something to get that out of their system. So I just took some bleach and water, and I sprayed that around.
No.
And they didn't come back the next year.
Well, you only have about 15 seconds, but Julie's shaking her head. So, Julie, I'll let you have the final one on this.
Well, no, I was just thinking pheromone seems unlikely with birds because most songbirds don't have a very good sense of smell. So, seems unlikely.
Well, Anne-Marie, we're going to have to leave it there. Hey, Rich Guthrie, when are you coming back to town? What is this?
I'll be there next May. I'll be there next show.
In May.
Sure.
Okay.
But in the meantime, April 27th, I'm leading a Hudson Mohawk Bird Club field trip to the Hanakoi Preserve.
All right.
Sunday, April 27th. Be there. Have fun.
How do people find out about that very quickly?
Hudson Mohawk Bird Club, hmbc.net, or richardpguthrie@gmail.com.
Julie Hart, how do people find out what you're doing, or do you want them to?
They can email me. It's julie.hart@dec.ny.gov.
Well, thank you both for being here. Support comes from InVivo Institute for Effective Communication, bringing telehealth speech therapy to listeners with a whole-person approach, helping clients make lasting changes to their lives. InVivoInstitute.org for information. Acres, Alden Country Real Estate Services, holistic transactional real estate brokerage serving the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. BerkshireAcres.com for information. At Curtis Lumber, providing materials from start to finish for any size, building or home improvement project. Daily delivery service available at CurtisLumber.com. Thanks again to Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie for being here. Thank you, Anne Marie. Thank you all for the poop questions. We've had enough. Maybe next month we'll do it again. Maybe not. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow we welcome back virologist Eric Yeager from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. We'll find out all about what's going to make you sick. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.